Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Hey, it's J. Michael Michael here for LA Talk Radio. And if you're like me and you love talk radio, but you can't find anything worth listening to in the AM dial, then how about this? How about you tune into LA Talk Radio? You see, LA Talk Radio is the biggest and the best in LA, and it's a .com, so we have it all from sports to music to self-help to just about anything, including talk. Right now we have the writer's block, the new writer's favorite show. So sit back, pour some more wine, open another box of chocolates, and relax because it all starts right now.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Russ Avison right here on LA Talk Radio.
Hey, it's Thursday night. This is LA Talk Radio, and you're listening to The Writer's Block. My name is Jim Christina. I am your host in studio tonight with my friend and co-host, Russ Avison.
Howdy, howdy. Wait, I got to stop you. What is this music? This was like the nicest thing you've ever
Hold
played.
Hold on. I'm fixing to tell you.
Oh, okay.
This isn't... Oh. Okay, well, here's a little more. This is in deference to our guest tonight. This is the opening theme to a movie called Cheyenne Autumn that came out in 1977 about the Cheyenne running off the reservations and trying to make their way back to their hunting grounds up in Wyoming.
Oh.
And they were at Fort Robinson, which was in Nebraska. So
it's beautiful.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? I did that for Chuck.
So, oh, very good.
Yeah.
I'm touched.
Well, you should be. Hey,
yes.
I'm glad you listened to that show the other night. If you all out there, if all of our hundreds of thousands of listeners, if you didn't get a chance to catch the show on Tuesday night, the special Writer's Block 1-on-1 with Tom Lang from LAPD, man, you got to tune into the show. It is up now. The podcast is there. It's an hour and 50 minutes, and it is fascinating. Tom Lang is a great guest and very knowledgeable and told us things we never heard about the OJ investigation.
Oh, it was amazing.
It was totally amazing.
It was a show that you couldn't do anything. I sat down at my computer. I was going to do some work and listen, and I quit doing what I was doing.
Yeah,
just listen
well,
to the
we
show.
Used to, Jerry and I were sitting here, and of course, Jerry was my co-host that night, and we were sitting here with our mouths open and just listening, just apt.
Yeah, but you kind of have that look on your face most of the time, anyway.
But Tom is so interesting and such a good storyteller. But his stories are true, you know. And it was some of the stuff that he was saying. Whoa!
I was a little shocked, though, that Jerry says, "Well, I have a question, and it's kind of gross." And she wanted to know what the bodies looked like after he had.
Oh yeah.
I was surprised about that.
Yeah, but he was so gracious, and, you know, we ran into him at dinner about a month ago.
Right.
And
at Sutter's Mill?
Yeah.
Of course.
And he and Linda were there having dinner, and I just walked up and, you know, I said, what the hell? He's a writer. I've got a writer's show. Might as well see if he can go on. And
he did.
He grabbed all the info, and immediately when he got home that night, sent us everything back.
Really?
Oh, yeah. He was totally stoked.
He was excited to do it.
He was. He was really excited to do it. He had a great time, and... You know, he got to be here with us.
Yes. Well,
of course,
that was
we had
the best part.
We had to be in Amber's studio, but that's okay. You know. Hey, we've got a guest tonight that I have to tell you that he's a first time writer. I'm going to give you some bio on this guy, and I just bear in mind, Chuck, that if you write this, we assume that it's true.
You may.
Okay. His name is Chuck Redman. He was born and raised in a small town in Nebraska, a place that still gives him chills. Is it cold? No.
Figuratively.
Even though the scenery is less dramatic than the goosebumps on his arm. And he eventually rambled east for undergrad at Michigan Law School at NYU, and he marched west to practice criminal and immigration. Oh, man, that would be a good right now, immigration law, in Los Angeles for 40 years. And in his spare time, he wrote a little. He's retired now, freeing himself to enjoy his wife and his kids, his reading, his writing, his worrying about the future of the planet. His novel, A Cottonwood Stand, set in Nebraska, takes a satirical look at the way our nation has chosen to evolve in terms of values. Mr. Redmond's daughter, a musician and artist, created a beautiful needlepoint of the story's legendary Cottonwood. And his son, a musician and community activist, adapted the needlepoint for the book cover. His short fiction of humor have appeared in Writer's Digest, Lowescroft Chronicle, Hemlock Journal, Jewish Literary Journal, and the Jewish Magazine. Please welcome to the Writer's Block, Mr. Chuck Redmond.
Thank you so much.
Well, welcome, and thank you for coming in. I mean, I understand, you know, driving to 101 at night, you know, can be a tough road to hoe, especially from where you live.
It was stressful.
At the time.
And it's a straight shot from your place to here, but it's just a lot of traffic.
It's getting worse and worse every...
It truly is.
Every single year.
It is just... It's unreasonable. And, you know, the nice part, I come down to 118, then I hit the 405 south. Virtually wide open traffic on the 405 at like 5:30, quarter to 6 in the evening until I get to the 101. And then it's really hard to merge onto the 101 from the 405 because the traffic is so thick. You know, so you just got to be a California driver, turn on your blinker, close your eyes, and go for it. You know,
I mounted a 50 caliber machine gun on the roof, and I clear people out of the way.
But your truck will do it.
And you only have to shoot one time, and everybody else gets out of the way. So there's one sacrificial lamb every trip in here. And
I'd like it.
It's clear.
And I noticed that there are no bullet holes.
Kidding.
There's no bullet holes in his Mercedes either.
No.
Well, you know, Chuck lives in Thousand Oaks, and actually next year or year after, they're changing the name of Thousand Oaks. Did you know that?
I did not.
Yes. You didn't know that.
Okay. Go ahead, Jen. What is the new name going
to
be?
Oak. Yes. There's only going to be one.
There's one Oak.
After the fire.
Yeah, well, that's my worst nightmare.
Well, that's everybody's worst nightmare that lives in Thousand Oaks. You know, they're going to wake up one morning and there's going to be new freeway signs, Oak, 5 miles.
Yes. And there'll be a bunch of people just standing around the one Oak.
Yeah. So Chuck has written a book. It's called A Cottonwood Stand, and it is a contemporary and historical novel of old Nebraska and new Nebraska. It's kind of mixed together. It's the newest protagonist is Janet. She's a writer.
Mm-hmm. Yep, she is.
And the
well, not just a writer though. She's the publisher.
She's a publisher and owner, and she does everything. Yeah. And of course, the town is so big. What is it like? You know.
Well, it's more than 7,000 people.
Well, there you go. That means they have two stoplights
for Nebraska. That's pretty big.
Yeah, that's a big town for Nebraska.
It is.
And then the protagonist for back in the 1800s is Lark.
Right.
Lark. And she is a Cheyenne woman.
She's a Ogallala Sioux.
Ogallala Sioux.
But the Sioux and the Cheyennes were
they were partners.
Close. Yeah. They were friends.
They were good. They were good buds.
Allies.
So, So, and I'm going to let Chuck take it from there, and we'll ask him a few questions about his book, and I want to find out where this story came from and all that other good stuff. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about the story, if you wouldn't mind, Chuck?
Yeah. We were talking about Thousand Oaks, and it is a kind of a special place because the way it protects its oak trees. And I come from Nebraska where there really aren't that many trees. You kind of, you know, I grew up kind of loving trees because there weren't that many of them, and the ones that there were beautiful, like the old cottonwoods. I always loved them because their leaves are shiny and they sparkle and you hear them kind of rustle in the wind. Mm-hmm. It's just something I always remembered, and then I was, you know, thinking about Thousand Oaks and the way it's building up, and like you said, we might, the way it's going, we'll be down to one
one oak tree.
So I started, it just kind of seemed like something I wanted to write about, a place that is dedicated to preserving trees, but the developers kind of are too powerful, and it just looks like the trees are going to lose out to, eventually lose out to the developers and industry and everything. So I thought that's what I wanted to write about. So I thought back about Nebraska and how Nebraska would be maybe a better place to set the story than California. Because I can make it a small town. And I don't know if you guys were born in small towns or big towns or...
No,
I was born in a big one, but I've been living in a small town since 2002.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So
yeah,
we only have 14,000 people. He lives in a small town now.
Yeah,
so
you could take, well, like Fillmore, California is kind of, it's kind of like a Cottonwood, Nebraska. It's a small town in the middle of nowhere, so to speak, and there's just something about growing up in a place like that that is special. So I guess that's where the story came from. I just wanted to write about how special these small towns are and the trees that grow in them. And so I started writing the story, and then I wanted to add something about the history of Nebraska and the Native Indian, the Native tribes that were there, because the Pawnee Indians were the tribe that had inhabited my part of Nebraska, central Nebraska. And they were a pretty amazing tribe. They had a pretty amazing culture. And so I wanted to have the modern story with the little town and the trees being part of its heritage. And then I wanted to have the story of the early Native Americans and how there's a connection between their existence and what's going on today. So I hope it worked out.
It's a nice read.
It's satire, and you know, not everybody's into satire, but that's kind of the way I wanted to look at things, look at the good things and the bad things, and kind of poke a little fun where, you know, where things could be better, could change.
But you know, you, even though it had satire, I mean, you brought, there were two things. There was one that, there's a poem that was written by one of the kids in school, I don't know if he was, you know, encouraged by the big companies that wanted to come into the big meatpacking company and take over the area. But he wrote about, you know, he didn't give a crap about the trees. And I thought, you little bastard.
From my perspective, he was writing tongue in cheek. And, his little poem was his way of creating a little satire upon the whole issue of the of the story. Big business versus the tree. I conceived of him as a somebody who loves books and poetry and loves nature. So I had him write the poem tongue-in-cheek. But it's, you could look at it both ways.
Yeah.
I mean, I could see looking at it both ways.
But you brought in, I mean, there was, when the Indians were honoring that buffalo and then they let him go, after they kind of like did like a little blessing, you know, for him. And you made a comment about it may not turn out this well if we meet again on during the hunt. But yeah. That scene, to me, it touched me. I mean, I'm a softy, first of all, but I kind of teared up a little bit because I thought, you know, this buffalo had no idea what was going on anyway. And he went out, and little did he know that they might meet again under different circumstances. But I got it maybe more out of the book than I should have. Well,
that's okay.
Apparently you did a lot of research.
Yeah, I had to do a lot on the Sioux tribe and on the Pawnee tribe.
Right.
Because, you know, I wanted to make it, I didn't want to make it into a, you know, nonfiction documentary,
yeah.
But I wanted to have enough to make it true to life and true to their values. So I read some Native American book, you know, authored books, and just did quite a bit of research on those two tribes to learn about their culture. And
how was it? Because I know Jim has talked several times about when you're trying to get the dialect correct, and when I was reading it, they spoke rather funny compared to the way we talk today. And how difficult was that to get into and develop?
That part was, for some reason I started writing the book in a dialect.
Yes, you did.
On the part of the narrator. And you don't, I know that's kind of weird, but the narrator, I wanted the narrator to be someone that kind of, someone timeless and someone who has that old homespun way of talking that kind of fits Nebraska, maybe not Nebraska today, but Nebraska back in the old days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So he talks in dialect, and I had to, I think, reading books like your books, Jim, because your book is basically dialect, that Western cowboy dialect, and I think where, you know, if it hadn't been for books like yours and the old cowboy movies, I don't think I would have been able to write that kind of dialect. So I think that's where that came from.
It's a job. It's a job to sit down and do it, I have to tell you. Because it's not simple. Especially when I did The Return, and I had to pick up the Cajun dialect. And the Cajun way of speaking, and you know, because they speak totally different than everybody else in the whole world, and it's getting their dialect down and the way they talked, because they talk in kind of a halting English, French, Spanish mixture, and it's just like nobody knows what they're talking about because nobody they can even speak English and you wouldn't know what they're saying because their accents are so thick, and that was a difficult part of writing The Return. Writing just regular Western dialect is continuity with each character, and I think that's the hard part, keeping the characters separate in the way they talk. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good way to develop your character and distinguish the different characters.
Right, right. I'll sit when I'm writing dialogue, and like if I write a large piece of dialogue, I'll sit and I'll just quietly mouth it to myself to make sure it works.
That it sounds right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then if it doesn't, the parts that aren't working, I go back and redo.
Sure.
And then Jerry goes.
I was going to say in the book he goes through it. She cuts it all up.
Everything else. Yeah. Sorry, Bookie. No, actually, she doesn't cut anything out of my books. She goes, far be it from me. You've written it. Far be it from me to take it out.
Not going to take it out, but I'm going to tell you how to
fix it. I'll tell you how to fix it.
She's your number one reader?
She's my number one editor.
Yeah.
You know, so.
By the way, just a side note. I noticed that other than the mention of the Wall Street Journal, you use fake names for a lot of, like, I think that instead of 7-Up, I think it was something called Sparkle Up. And instead of Huggies for the diapers, you had another name. Why yes. did you choose to do that? Because it was just kind of stood out to me.
I tried to do that. And even the towns, I mean, the town of Cottonwood is fictional. And the other towns where I wrote about that they had meatpacking plants mm-hmm. were fictional too, because I didn't want to somehow cast negative thoughts, you know, on real towns mm-hmm. and real companies. And I don't know, it just seemed like, I mean, people know when if you say yeah, like I think it was Spritzy Up.
Spritzy Up. Yeah, there was a name like that.
Spritzy Up.
They know you're talking about 7-Up, but
sure.
I
knew what it was. And the Huggies, instead of Huggies, you had another name. In fact, you mentioned both of them.
Oh,
both of the big names.
It was, I can't remember.
I don't remember exactly now.
Wiped it from his memory.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I wanted to keep the everything more generic mm-hmm. so uh-huh. that people could, readers would say, oh, this, he's writing about all of this type of company or this type of business or this type of town or mm-hmm. that it would all become a little more generic than just, oh, he's talking about a certain, you know, particular place. Or,
right.
Yeah.
I noticed you seem to be a fan of Laugh-In. You made several comments about or just referrals to some of the things from Laugh-In, like Bet Your Bippy and what else did you have in your head? I don't remember. It was the one guy he always was quoting from that.
The character that does the Laugh-In stuff, he did an Artie Johnson
right
bit. And
very interesting.
Very interesting.
But that's not what you had. Funny,
but that's funny. Yes.
Yes. Laugh-In. Well, I was in high school, and Laugh-In was. We all started using those.
Oh, sure.
Those expressions.
Sure.
Sock it to me. That was one from that.
When Nixon was on. Sock it to me.
Yeah. That right. Yeah. That's right.
And. Yeah, I just thought it'd be a good.
No, it was fun.
I wanted something to distinguish that character,
mm-hmm.
that you know, make him a little quirky and make that part of his character.
So you always have one though that walks around repeating lines off of TV shows.
Yeah, because they can't think for themselves.
I mean, there's always one in every group.
Yes,
you know that. You know, it says, hey, "What do you think, Russ?" Well, you bet your bippy.
Yeah. Yeah. And that I would be the one that would do that.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, you know, right now it's Chuck the one that does that.
Yeah.
The question I have for you, and I've kind of been thinking about this for a day or two. You mentioned in this book, and you mentioned a lot of things in this book. For the size of this book, you mentioned a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, every small town you go to in Nebraska has a meatpacking plant. Is that really true, or is that just the way this character is looking at it?
Well, that's... a lot of them do now, but when I was there, it wasn't like that. The meatpacking plants were basically in Omaha and maybe a couple other towns, but they were, you know, great big plants where the stockyards were.
Mm-hmm.
And Omaha was the city with the stockyards. And then, you know, also Denver and Sioux City and Chicago, and of course those were all stockyards towns. But then these companies started opening smaller plants closer to where the cattle were raised, which was mm-hmm. like in central Nebraska. So the ranching and all the cattle business became more corporate. And they'd have, you know, stockyards. You'd see, you could drive across Nebraska then and start seeing big, huge stockyards of cattle just waiting to go go to market, so to speak. And so the meat company started putting these little meatpacking plants in the little towns.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these towns totally changed. And to me, it was not, they did not change for the better, because it brought in a lot of people all of a sudden who had no ties to that community. The towns got crowded. These were little, you know, quiet little Nebraska towns, and they started getting kind of overbuilt, and schools were too full,
and crime was up.
Yeah, crime was up, and so this started happening. And I could have, you know, if I had this started really back in the 70s, and you know, I wish I had seen what was happening and written a book way back then, but I didn't. So. Mm-hmm. It's still going on. You know, they're still building plants
mm-hmm.
in small towns. But lots of towns don't have them yet. And some towns, they're in that situation right now. The company wants to put a plant there, and the people don't want it. And it's becoming...
And the big corporations come in and say, oh, listen, we're going to do all these great things for your town.
Right.
We're going to bring in lots of jobs, and you're going to have lots of people coming to... go into your shops, but it doesn't.
I mean, those little towns will never be the same. And, you know, they'll still be good towns. You know, a lot of good things can still happen in those towns, but they'll never be like they were.
No, so, I think there's something to be said for keeping some of the, you know, small town America
small.
Around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I look in the town where I live, and like I say, we have 14,000 people. And there's been times when I think, you know, this town could be so much more
mm-hmm.
If the city fathers would say, you know, let's try and work on this as being a destination so people want to come in and visit, just to build, you know, the tourist trade, but not expand the size of the town. But instead, they're going a completely different direction, and they're just putting houses. But the main street, you go down the main street, there's store after store after store is closed down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The only thing we really have going out there is the Fillmore Western Railroad.
Yeah. Yeah, which goes through the Orange Grooves.
Yeah, it goes from Fillmore, and it goes out to Santa Paula
and back.
And they do like murder mystery trains.
Yeah.
And they have full course dinners they serve on the train. I mean, it's nice.
Yeah.
But they could do so much more.
So are the people of Fillmore, are they... trying to stop this kind of growth from happening?
Apathetic would be the word I would use.
Oh.
Yeah, a lot of small towns, if people get apathetic, and apathy seems to be the word of the day. I'm going to take a few minutes here, do a couple commercials, and we'll get back to you. So don't go away. And don't you either. Did you want to do Bobby Jeans?
No, go ahead. Do whatever you want.
Thanks.
I read a cold.
No, I'll there. Do it. I got it.
Yeah,
I got it.
We'll just talk among ourselves.
Yeah, well, I'm going to turn you off, so go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Has cabin fever got you down? Turn your mind away from this winter's storms and things, and think spring. Now's the time to refresh your outlook. What events do you have coming up? Outdoor music festivals? Trip to the mountains, perhaps? Horseback ride adventure? Out West Shop has what you need to revive your spirits and reboot your wardrobe. Cool, hip, boho tops? Stylish boots from Dan Post and a great-looking jackets are just a few of the fashion essentials offered for men and ladies. Find it all at outwestshop.com. Enter coupon code SPRING and save $10 on your order. Call toll-free at 877-340-9378. Outwest delivers the West door-to-door, coast-to-coast, and around the world. So go to outwest.com. Outwestshop.com, or give them a call. Talk to Bobby Jean or Jim Bell at 877-340-9378. And J. Michael here for All Dogs Rule. You know, if you're planning a trip and there's no way you can take your little canine buddy, then how about considering All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepover? That's right. All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepover is the premium place for your four-legged buddies to spend their time away from you. If you want a place where you know your buddy will be safe and have lots of attention, being able to play with other dogs, goats, sheep, horses, and more humans, then All Dogs Rule is the place for you. Acres of play space, grass, orange trees, the gorgeous Sespe River, and all with no stress and extras if you want. All you need to do is ask. When your dogs return home, you'll have to ask whose vacation was better. Well, whose vacation was better, Russ? The dog. You're off, so yeah. So check them out and check out their website at alldogsrule.com or give them a call at 805-524-1100. And I know Russ and Karen will love to hear from you, and they actually would love to have your dog, of course, because they need the money. So your dog will thank you, and we thank you. Okay, we're back in the studio. Thank you, Jesus. The time is now 7:30. If you want to call and talk to Chuck tonight, the number here in the studio is 818-602-4929. Again, that number is 818-602-4929. And we're speaking with Mr. Chuck. What is your last? No. Oh yeah, Redmond. I knew more. That. You know what? I'm sitting here. I half the time we had Tom Lang on the show last Tuesday. Oh. Everybody knows who Tom Lang is. I couldn't remember his name. Tom, who? I don't know. It's getting old thing just doesn't work anymore. God.
All right, Chuck. Who is your model for Janet?
I was just going to ask the same question.
Oh, so. Wow, Janet.
And I have to tell you, I'm a big fan of the NBC television show The Good Place, and there's a main character, and that is Janet.
Oh,
and,
yeah,
and
yeah.
So as
we don't
I'm
watch
reading
it,
your
but
book,
I know she is.
All I'm thinking about is this Janet, who happens to be a robot in the
oh,
show.
Oh, okay. Is that the one with Kristen Bell?
Yeah.
Yes.
Bell.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Janet. Wow.
Watch, he's going to go, wait a minute. Oh, yeah, it was my wife.
No. Yeah, no.
Well, Janet's got a temper, so.
Yes, she does.
I can't say it's my wife. Well.
Good catch on that one, Chuck.
Yes, you scored points there.
I did.
I don't know. I think, I don't know where Janet came from, really, but I think from maybe some of the old movies, Betty Davis, maybe. Lauren McCall.
Wow.
You know, these tough.
Red lipstick, smoking cigarette.
Tough women.
Tough, hardcore 40s yeah. women. Yeah. I like it.
But I never thought of that before. But she's, yeah, she's a tough lady, and that's what I wanted. I mean, she's a journalist, and I wanted somebody who really was going to fight, you know, for these Cottonwoods. And
I almost thought she was going to be taken in by Cosetti, though.
Well, she actually. Well, that's part of the plot we don't want to give away.
Right, I don't want. But
that's a spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Cosetti is.
He's the consul general.
He's not. Yeah, he's consul. General counsel of the meat company.
Right.
And.
And a smooth talker and a good-looking guy.
Yes, he is.
And he would naturally gravitate towards Janet because Janet's a smooth talker and a good-looking girl.
Yeah. But it's
attitude.
Quite in the beginning of the book. You already can start to see there's something going to happen. And that's what you're...
Yeah.
Without giving away anything.
But, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and I didn't think that there was going to be romance in this book because I don't read romance novels, and
then you're the perfect guy to write one.
Yeah, no kidding.
Oh, I am.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why?
Because you should write about things you don't know anything about.
Because if you don't know about romance, two things will happen. Number one, you'll write a great romance novel.
Because it'll be
number
real.
Number two, you'll go home and your wife will be gone. Is she listening?
She might be listening.
And her name is what?
Gila.
Oh, hi, Gila. This is Russ. He's talking crap about you.
Hi, honey.
Where's Gila from?
She's from Iran.
Iran. Okay.
And so she, she was my first reader of this book.
Yeah.
And my kids too, and
they all stuck with you after they read it. So that's a good sign.
They did. Yeah. My son had a few, you know, problems with the stereotyping of Native Americans and that stuff. But I respect that. And Gila had a hard time with the dialect because her English is, you know, her English is great, but she didn't grow up here. She came here in her mid-20s. And so this kind of dialect, you know, talking like a cowboy or a farmer, she has trouble in deciphering that dialect. So I had to let her read my synopsis, and then I had to answer all her questions about what is really happening.
Yeah.
What's really happening.
Do these words mean put together?
Yes. Yeah. So it's a little tough. All of her relatives, I think most of them have copies of the book, but I don't expect them to really get it the way.
Yeah.
Somebody who's from this country.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Sure. It helps to grow up here, you know, to know the way cowboys talk.
And, mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, especially Midwesterners, they have their own way of speaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like it's like people from Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, they talk like Canadians.
To some extent, they do.
Yeah.
Oh, there was something very interesting in here. Somebody pointed out to me about 10 years ago that when I would say, the proper way to say it would be, all you need to do. But what I would say is, all's you need. And I noticed that you wrote some dialogue saying all's instead of all. And I tried to figure out, where did this come from? And Karen actually pointed out to me. She goes, you said all's. No, I didn't.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I did. And I found out, I picked it up from my mother. And my mother, she would, anytime you'd point out any flaw at all. No, I didn't say that.
Oh, yeah.
Mom, you did, really, because I say it, you know, and I know now I hear it when you speak. I do not say that. And she would never cop to it. But, and then I've heard it in a few films. So you pulled that. That's definitely something from the Midwest. Yeah.
I think it is because I heard it growing up as a little kid. I know my best friend across the street, he would say that. So I started saying it.
Mm-hmm.
And his parents were, his father, I guess, was a native Nebraskan. And I do occasionally hear people say it out here even. Mm-hmm. I heard a guy say it just the other day. He's a handyman. And he's born and raised right here in, I think in...
Oak?
In Oak. In Oak. He saw the original Oak. he said, all you got to do.
Yeah.
And boy, that sounds so good when you hear it from mm-hmm. somebody, because it just sounds so familiar.
Yeah.
And homey.
Homey.
And it's homey. It's just like dialogue. And I mean, people, that was the biggest thing I get from people reading my books is that, boy, it took me a long time to get into the rhythm of this dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how they talked.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did. When I started the book, I had to start it three times.
First five pages.
Yes. I had to start it because I tried. It didn't have a flow at first to me because I didn't know where it was going.
However, I will tell you, if you get on Amazon and read his reviews, most of the people say that.
Oh, really?
They've had to start. They started the book a couple, two, three times before they realized that they had to go back and put the pentameter to the words.
Yes.
And then they got it.
But I also noticed you got like 4.8 stars or something.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, so a lot of five stars in this book.
Well,
nothing below three.
Well, it is. It's a little tough. I know you don't expect to open up a book and see all this.
Go right into colloquial English.
Dialect and this bad grammar. And And
I just thought, who the heck wrote this? They don't even know what they're doing.
I know,
And you'd be right.
Well, that's what you have to keep telling your editors, you know, don't correct the grammar. Or don't correct the dialogue. Mm-hmm. Leave the dialogue alone. It's there for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You know, the regular English part, fine, have fun with it, but don't mess with my dialogue.
Yeah. Well, like I read your book, Taggart.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because I wanted to read at least one of your books before I came here, and it was total dialect, and it was so perfect. It was just, you know, I was very impressed by the dialect. It just sounded like you're right there with these guys, you know, 100 years ago living in the Wild West. I mean,
Chuck, you're already on the show. You don't have to kiss up.
Yeah.
But I love cuz that dialect is it's kind of, I hate to say it, but it's probably a dying language.
It is.
It's not going to be around,
you know,
200 years from now,
right,
or whatever. So I like to see it preserved.
And used.
And used, yeah.
Just like the small towns. I mean,
yeah.
It really is the same thing.
Yeah. There's so much, so rich in culture and personality. It has such a flavor that you hate to lose that kind of thing.
Well, we shouldn't, because we shouldn't lose our roots. We should know how this country evolved.
Well, they're trying to make us lose our roots.
Oh, I know.
I totally. That's for another show.
Yes, definitely so.
Quickly, I want to ask you about Lark, because Lark goes on a journey. She goes on a mission.
Yes.
Mission from God to go save her half-sister.
Yes.
And to bring her back to the adopted Pawnee tribe that she came from.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And then she gets caught up in the intrigue of the whole thing, and they're not going to let her go. And it's as far as I'm going to go with this, because it does get a little interesting in there. But it was interesting that she defied everything and went on this journey.
Yeah, she's kind of a Janet Henderson,
right?
From another era. I really admire the Sioux culture, the Pawnee culture, and that's why I wanted to write about them. But still, women didn't have the kind of power that they deserved,
right?
And so she was a strong-minded young woman, and took things into her own hands and stood up for what she believed in, took a chance. And that's what I wanted to have in that part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted the ancient story to have as much as powerful a woman protagonist as the modern story.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there was a lot of similarities here.
Yeah, there was.
I just was curious, when you, because you would be, as you read through a chapter, and it's modern day, and suddenly the next paragraph is going back in time.
Right.
How do you decide, like, and maybe it was natural in your mind, but how did you figure that, okay, now I'm going to insert, we're going to go back, and then we're going to come forward? Because it flip-flops back and forth, which in a way is good, because you can't get lazy reading this book. You have to stay focused.
Yeah, it's true, because it changes so rapidly.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's that makes it a little harder book to read too. It's things aren't always spelled out. You kind of have to put two and two together sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like you said, the chronology is kind of tricky. So the whole book takes place over 10 days' time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same. It's 10 days' time both in the modern story and the ancient story. So they're both moving. They're both starting at the same point in that 10 days, at the beginning of 10 days, and moving at the same rate through the book. And then they end, you know, at basically the same place.
Right.
So that's why I had to time everything right, mm-hmm. you know, correctly, so that it would all be chronological.
Sure.
And I hope that didn't make it too hard to follow.
It was like the beginning of the book. Once you realized what you had to invest to get into it, then it was easy. And you did name the chapters by day of the week, so that was, you knew that was happening.
Yeah.
So it was just, you know, it's like anything else. It's when you watch a movie, in the first few minutes, you're trying to figure out who are the characters, why is this person, and then you get in the flow of the film, and then it goes real smoothly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
mm-hmm.
what I found with the book too. It just, you, once you realize how it's going to move, then it's really simple.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks.
we always ask this question to our writers, because it's we always are very interested into what their take on it is, and you know what the question's going to be.
I think so.
This, of course, is the writer's block. And have you ever had writer's block? And if you did, how did you get out of it?
I think what I have is, I don't think I've ever had a block per se, but I think I have a lot of writer's inertia or laziness. I know if I sit down in front of the computer, I can start writing and pick up where I left off. But it's just getting myself to sit down and start doing it is hard because I'm retired and it's...
screw work.
There are other things.
You know what? I'm getting worse.
Yeah, let's be honest about it.
I'm getting worse.
I like to take naps and, do other things besides write. But I love writing, so I have to kind of overcome a little bit of laziness and just sit down and make myself, start mm-hmm. putting something down on paper.
Do you ever have times when you... like all of a sudden an idea goes off in your head and you like all of a sudden you have this energy
burst
to sit down.
A burst of writing.
And you're just going and you something just hits you.
Yeah, that does happen sometimes. Sometimes I wake up in the morning.
That's a good thing.
Or
you're retired, I mean, after all.
or the middle of the night and then something hits me and I have to get up and write it down. Otherwise I'll forget it.
Sure.
By the time I wake up the next time. And sometimes those are ideas that really turn out to be okay, something I could use. Sometimes they're not, but I don't know what causes it. I guess there's a scientific explanation for how our brain works, but something just flashes sometimes and it's just, oh my God, that would be so perfect for this character, this part of the plot.
I can tell when that's happened to Jim, like the day before, because he'll come in and he'll go, oh, man, I just finished writing the best 10 pages I've ever... And
I know,
it is
huh?
so... Yeah, wow. But you can tell. Yeah. There's a certain excitement there that I know something good happened.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this news book, I mean, the whole book is good, so...
Yeah, wow. See, like, the whole book's good.
The whole book is good. I wrote a book. I had the same thing. I woke up in the middle of the night, actually, and I went back to sleep, but I woke up in the morning, and... a whole story was in my head, start to finish, names, everything. Oh, wow. Everything was there, and that was became Jonah Blue.
Right.
And Jonah Blue actually was a dream,
and
I just woke up, and it was there. It still took me 9 months to write the book, but the whole story was already there. It was already laid out for me.
Oh, my gosh.
Start to finish, I knew exactly what was going to happen, and that's where you got to be careful with your dialogue and stuff. But... and researching that Jonah Blue took a lot of research. I had no idea that they called the desert in Utah the Big Salty.
Really?
And they did. It was called the Big Salty, and they used to. Oh, and they gosh. Probably they crossed it. And they said, he'd say, well, how long is it going to take us to get across the desert? And it's the Big Salty. No one's ever made it. We know how to get there. It's just if we were lucky enough to find the Green River, we're okay. Lucky enough to find the Green River. Lucky enough. Because, these corps of engineers, the corps of discovery, used to come out and they would use this book that was written by a guy that had never been out here. And they would get lost and get killed. And Are you a pantser or do you write outlines?
Oh, somewhere in the middle, but yeah.
Seat of the pantser.
Not a pantser, no. And I don't write real outlines, but I kind of write a lot of notes, and I guess you could call them outlines, only they're not formal. They're not formal, but I do write down a lot of notes and ideas, and it takes me a long time to write.
If you're a good writer, it does. What's your next project?
It's going very slowly, but it's...
Well, you are retired, Chuck. We got that. We've already got the pin in that wall.
Yeah.
We're good.
But I'm... Yeah, it has nothing to do with Nebraska. It's about a retired couple, so I can definitely relate to it. And it's coming out a little bit satirical, and it's about this retired couple that is finding out that retirement brings a little too much togetherness, and also a lot of loneliness. Mm-hmm. So the guy is really sort of the main focus, and I think, you know, there's probably going to end up a lot of myself in him.
Do they live in Oak?
They live in somewhere in, you could say Oak.
Yeah, okay.
It's someplace like Oak.
But what an interesting comment to say how it brings a little bit too much togetherness and loneliness. Mm-hmm. You don't equate those two being together.
Yeah, it's, I don't want to give anything away either on this, but one night my wife and I were watching something on television, and I started thinking how much more fun it would be if we had another couple here just mm-hmm. to, you know, have
to share the
share.
And but it's just two of us sitting here, and it's great, but it can be lonely too. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of where it starts, and
I think this sounds promising.
We'll see where it goes.
Me too. And with that, we're going to have to close it out because we are out of time.
Thank you so much, you guys.
It just flew by.
It did really fast.
And thanks so much for taking the chance
and
coming down the 101 to visit us. It was great having you.
Thank you so much. I just want to say what you guys have here is the world's funnest book club.
Oh, okay. I think. Thanks.
Because you guys are so much fun to listen to.
Well, we have a good time.
Thank you.
And it's all about books. And I just thank you so much for letting me be here.
You're very welcome.
It's a pleasure.
It's our pleasure to have you. And the book is called The Cottonwood Stand. You can find it on Amazon, all the online booksellers. And, it's, of course, Mr. Chuck Redman is the author. If you check out on the cover, that's his daughter and his son's handiwork.
Yeah, which you said this was originally embroidered, right?
She did an embroidery of this cottonwood tree.
It's really nice.
It's beautiful. It's hanging in my kitchen.
And, oh, that's very awesome. Cool.
And then my son found a way to make it into this cover.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love
did
it.
Did a good job.
It's
did a good job. And I'm a big fan of cottonwood trees.
Oh,
I love them.
Good.
Especially stands of them and copses of them mm-hmm. where the breeze rolls through and they actually talk to you. And then you see the shimmer of the silver side of the leaves as they go through. And see, I know about cottonwood trees.
You sure do. Oh, yeah. My God. That
they're great. So and it always seems like it's 30 degrees cooler under them when you lay underneath a cottonwood tree. But then the rattlesnakes think that, too, so they're under there with you. But next week, of course, Bob and Bobby will be back with us. We have Mr. Jim Jones, who is Western Entertainer of the Year. Singer-songwriter. He's got a new album, actually two new albums out, and he's also written a new book. And so we'll be talking about his new book and his new album. And we have the Cowboy Festival coming up in April, second weekend in April, which is going to be fun. It's at William S. Hart Park in Newburgh, or Newberry. No, Newburgh? No.
No, Newburgh?
Newhall.
Newhall, there you go. I see the sign off the freeway.
Yeah. Newhall, that's where that's going to be. And then Junie Fisher, who's also a singer-songwriter and a writer, author, will be here on the 9th. We'll have another special, Writer's Block, one-on-one. And Bobby Jean will be here with us. So we got a lot of stuff coming up this first 6 months of the year. And I'm going to say goodnight to Chuck. Thanks you so much, Russ, for coming in. And,
oh, always
and
fun.
And as always, I'm Jim Christina for Russ Evison, Bobby Jean Bell, Bob Brill, and the Writer's Block. We are out of here.